Okay, thanks, Marty. Thanks, Massimo. It's great to be here. And the talk that I will give today is joint work with Michael Lessie. And me and Michael, we were lucky enough to join forces with Kurt Callan and Justin Kinney in Princeton, and we did a joint project on binding site evolution in yeast. And this is one of the case studies that I will discuss today. And I will only focus to one question, which I think is very interesting. So what is the genomic signature of adaptive evolution? And after I'm done, I hope that I have made the point clear that it's not enough to prove positive selection to prove adaptive evolution. And one should view adaptation as a purely non-equilibrium phenomenon, which can then be quantified with positive fitness flux, which I will define soon. And then I just illustrate this difference between mere positive selection and then positive selection with adaptation by two case studies. One is this yeast binding site evolution, and the other one is fruit fly genomes. And let us start with an example of a static fitness landscape. So this is the classic one locus, two alleles model. So there's right freezer process, there's drift, mutation, and selection. And throughout the talk, I will operate at the parameter regime where the effective population size, n times the mutation rate, mu, is much smaller than one. And in this regime, this is where most genomes are. And in this regime, the process, let's have two alleles, A prime and A, and they have a fitness difference, which I will call sigma. And throughout the talk, I might confuse between delta F and sigma, but this is how they are linked. So it's just a notation. I probably use them interchangeably. And here is one example of this evolution under this process, under static fitness landscape. So what I have plotted here is first of all, this shading, this background shading will give you the fitter state, the lighter the fitter. So it means that A prime allele has now this advantage sigma with respect to the A. And I plot here as a y-coordinate is the population fraction of allele A prime. And the x-axis is scaled in the units of the mutational time scale. So it's a very long time scale that I'm plotting here. And you can see that when we operate at this regime where this mu times n is small, this evolution then consists of monomorphic states. And then there's a substitution process, and you are monomorphic in the other state, or mostly monomorphic. There's of course some polymorphism around. And then you make another substitution. And it's intuitively clear that if I now denote downhill substitutions which lower the fitness by sigma with a triangular, blue triangular, I go one down here, then I go one up with red one, which is positive sigma, which is positive. This is sigma which is negative because you went to the lower state. And if I keep on going like this, it will become boring after a while. So I always go down, I go up, I go down, I go up. And this will lead to an equilibrium state. And we can define the equilibrium by condition which is called detailed balance. So suppose now that we have certain probability that we are in the lower state here. Let's denote that probability Q of A. And then there's a transition from A to A prime. And that carries, in this previous picture, a fitness advantage. So I have this fitness advantage plus delta F, and I mark it with the red arrow. And then I can see the reverse process, that I start from the state Q A prime. I start from the state A prime, and its probability is Q A prime. And there is this reverse substitution. And at detailed balance, it just says that these fluxes will exactly cancel each other. And I take this as a definition of the equilibrium in this talk. And then I can define something which I call fitness flux, which is basically the rate of fitness increase per unit time. And if this flux is zero, we can see that the fitness flux is zero at equilibrium. And now we can go from this individual trajectory that I showed in the previous slide and make a more probabilistic view of the process. So let's look at first time averages. We look at the long, or we can also take many independent populations, and we can take an average out of them, and we can make a distribution. Now this x-coordinate tells you the probability of being, this is the population fraction of A prime, and here is the probability that the process it at will be at that state. So if I have a neutral process, which is shown in the green line here, it's completely symmetric because I don't have any mutational bias here. So it's equally likely to be here all A's or all A primes. And now the case that I showed you earlier, where A prime had the fitness advantage, this is the red line. And it shows that you're more likely to spend time at the A prime state population, mostly monomorphic in the A prime. And it's even so that the ratio of probabilities of being in the fit and less fit state is e to the fitness. So that's exponentially suppressed the probability of being in the lower fit state.
And this is an example where you set sigma to 1 or something.
This is an example, I think it's 2, because you can see it's still high probability here that you are in the... This is like sigma values that will make all the difference across evolutionary time, but you know, you can be also at the low end. So you compete with drift. And you can now, how you get to this kind of curves, you can either take these time averages, or you can write a probabilistic equation from this individual for this process. And this is the diffusion equation that Kimura did. So it's a Fokker-Planck equation. You can solve it, and you get equilibrium distributions for different sigmas, different mu's, and so forth. And you can then look also more carefully at the time evolution. So let's just think that we start at the initial state, which is x is naught. So we start in population that is monomorphic at allele A. And now if we let the process run for time delta t, we can ask that what is the probability distribution of the coordinate x, the population fraction of A prime. And you can see that you get different spectrums for different situations. So if I have a neutral one, it looks like this. If I now have advantage for A prime, you can see that you have more substitutions and more high-frequency polymorphism with respect to the neutral one. And then if I reverse the process that I say that A is now the fitter one, not A prime, that's, of course, just the same idea if I would start from 1 and let the original process run. So you can see that you are actually suppressed in substitutions. And this kind of distributions then you can use later in and interpret genomic averages with them. And I will come back to that. I have to just say that in a real system, when you do this, you don't know a priori how to bin or how to make the ensemble average. So it will be the real genomic averages will then have some linear combination of these. And then it becomes much harder to see what is going on there. And of course, if I now let this delta t go to infinity, I get back the equilibrium distribution. Okay, so if I just recap what I just said under evolution, under static fitness landscape with drift, selection, and mutations. So the evolution will reach an equilibrium state with the number of substitutions with positive selection coefficients equals that of negative ones. So that basically says that going up and down, they just compensate for the previous. Positively selected substitutions just compensate for the previous deleterious substitutions. And the fitness flux is zero. So if I now have a distribution of selection coefficients, let's say exponential distribution, and I have many independent loci evolving under these conditions, and I record all the substitution events that I see, the selection coefficients of all the substitution events, I will have a symmetric plot here. And this is just another way of saying that the fitness flux is zero. And I will claim that this fitness flux is a very useful concept here. And it basically means that if fitness flux is zero, there's no adaptive evolution going on. So at equilibrium, if the fitness landscape is static, you can't have sustained adaptive evolution. So you can think about the system that you are far from the equilibrium, and then for a while, when the system will reach the new equilibrium state, then for that while you will have a fitness flux that is different from zero. But then it dies out. And let's just now, it's quite obvious that this situation, this minimal model, which had important components of evolution, like drift selection and mutation. But the static thing is not something that is very, very much tuned what we think about adaptation. So adaptation, I think, is something that people see that it's a dynamic process. So there are species competing with each other, and there are new habitats to be found. And that is something that is then obviously missing from this static fitness landscape. And now I'll just make a minimal change to this picture and see what happens, whether we can then define or find a minimal model for adaptive evolution. So I call it a macroevolutionary fitness seascape. So it's the same model as the previous one, but now I have a new process. I allow for the selection to change as a function of time with the stochastic rate gamma. So you can see here, I've now painted this again, this fitness, the lighter shading indicates the current fitter state. And now at some point, this A state becomes the fitter. You can see here's a switch of selection. And then there's another switch, and so forth. And the time scale for these switches is 1/γ. And you can see what happens. You before the switch, you're more likely to be at the current fitter state. Then there's a switch, and then you make an adaptive substitution. You go to the new fitter state. Then you continue. Then there's another flip, and you make another adaptive substitution. And you can see that you can reach a non-equilibrium steady state where you have a surplus of substitutions going uphill. And this then will lead to a positive fitness flux in the system. And this is now something that we have done a minimal change to this model, which is that we allow for these selection changes at the time, at the rate gamma. And I will now show you that minimal change is already making things much more complicated, but not so complicated that you can't make progress when you analyze the system. And I will now talk you through 8 orders of magnitude of these fluctuations. I show you here for this process 2 observables that I think are very good at building intuition what is going on. So there are many other observables, but I think they will explain what is going on well. So, yes?
So you're talking using non-equilibrium stat mag terms, right? And you are discussing some steady state.
Mm-hmm.
And you introduce flux, which means that you probably have some injection and dissipation. So can you see what it is in this?
I'll come back what would cause this. So what is, why there would be such a thing? Like why there isn't flips in the selection? This I come back later.
So you'll get some interpretation.
Yes. Okay. So this degree of adaptation, what I mean by that is that if the system is not adapted at all, if we are here very low, zero state, it basically means that the probability of being, if you sample one allele from the process, the probability that that allele is in the current fitter, is the current fitter type, is equal to that of it being the other one. So there's no bias. It doesn't reflect anymore the direction of selection. And so you can see that if I have an equilibrium system, you are much more likely to draw the fitter allele when you draw a sample from the system. Okay? And then once you don't have this bias, so
it, what is H?
H is degree of adaptation. Right. So it goes to zero. Sorry?
How is defined?
I'm trying to say it, I say it again. So okay. So it's the probability that it's the bias in the probability that you draw the fitter allele. Okay? So if there's no bias, then you know, you draw an allele and it doesn't tell you anything about the fitness. They are equally likely. The less fit state and the fitter state are equally likely. But if there is a bias, then you're more likely to draw the current fitter allele. Okay?
This block is in a huge fitness difference.
It's 20. So that's typical number. Sigma 20 is typical number that you get in Drosophila. And substitution rate is, of course, very important observable. And you can see what happens in this regime. So you increase the rate of this driving, of the probability of these flips. And at this regime, you make the adaptive substitution. So there's a linear increase as a function of this non-equilibrium parameter here, this gamma. And so you can actually, I've written here analytical treatment using Quent's theory. So you can see why this is quite nice, this plot that I show you here. So you can't derive a diffusion equation for this process, because the time scale for the diffusion, which is the 2 times n, it's very much shorter than the time scale for these flips. So you can treat this so that this selection flips are a quenched process. And then this drift, the genetic drift, which is the noise in the reproduction, that's the annealed process. And you do first the annealed averages. So you can derive diffusion or forward flux. If you start from here, what is your polymorphism spectrum going to look like? And then you can, for this quenched process, you can do the substitutions. So you can solve in this limit, you can solve actually this complicated process with two different stochastic terms. But usually, like, if you have two different stochastic terms, things get very difficult. But if the time scale of those stochastic terms is different, then you can still get results there. And let's see what happens if we now start increasing the rate of fluctuations here. So we go to the middle picture. So there's a crossover region.
Excuse me, can you write equations with those two stochastic terms? So it would be linear.
The stochastic terms, okay. So that's a diffusion equation.
These two noises?
Yes.
So where is the end? So just two additive noises?
Sorry?
Two additive noises in diffusion. Can you write diffusion?
Okay, so I write you down the Langevin equation. So this one is here the drift. Right, so that's the Langevin equation that will give you this process. So it's a Poisson process of the noise, and like I said, we can deal with that in this regime. Could you turn the lights, please? So we can deal with that in this regime when the time scale for this changes of the selection and the drift time scale are very much different. But now if we increase the fluctuations, the rate of fluctuations or switching of the selection, we will get something, we can call it a crossover from macro to microevolutionary fitness C-scape. And here it's very important to notice that I have now changed the scaling of the time. So I really have changed the time, the fluctuations a lot. I have increased them a lot, and I'm now plotting it as in units of the diffusion time scale. And you can see that this is the very complicated regime, because the diffusion and the stochastic fluctuation or switches in the selection are of the same order of magnitude. And you can see that like this quenched solution will break down, you have substitution rate, which actually has a maximum in that region, which is very interesting. And then it starts declining again. And
so Philip,
yes?
When you have this is switching from one preferred state to another.
Yes.
What, or so in the quenched limit, what is limiting? So what sets the waiting time until you switch? Is that the time you need to diffuse, or is it the time you need to wait for the mutation?
That's the polymorphism time.
And n times nu was much smaller than 1, wasn't it?
Yeah. And
there's some waiting time.
Yes. 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 And then if we go even further, this is something which is very, very interesting. This is microevolutionary fluctuation. So I've gone even much to faster fluctuations. And it's actually this microevolutionary fluctuation regime is the one that people have discussed extensively in the classical population genetic literature, like Kimura, Wright, Orta, Gillespie, and others. And now it's intuitively very clear what you can do here. It doesn't anymore matter for one of these trajectories. The individual realization of the noise doesn't matter anymore. So what you can do here is that you can write an effective diffusion equation for both of these noises. And That actually is exactly what Takahata, Ishii, and Matsuda, and Takahata and Kimura have done for this process. So that is now this dashed line here that I have in these plots. So they have dealt with effective diffusion equation in that, they have derived one, and they have solved many quantities for that region. And then, so it's quite easy to see from the plot that you could imagine that you don't have to anymore care about individual flips here. So this is like, you can have a flip at any couple of generations, for instance. And the diffusion equation for this thing that we are now studying, which has the mean selection zero, actually depends only on the variance of the selection. So this diffusion theory has only parameter combinations for the selection, which is sigma squared divided by gamma. And if you remember Justin Fay's talk, and where he mentioned that this recent paper by Huerta Sanchez from Carlos Bustamante's group mentioned that this is actually one mechanism that you can confound your tests for positive selection, that you are here. So you are pumping up, you go above the neutral rate, and then you would actually, maybe you would infer positive selection, but the mean selection is zero. This is of course very interesting, but then you can think about that as a mode of evolution across the whole genome is not very, very sensible. Because then if you agree that is the dynamics, you also have to agree that you are not adapted at all. And that, of course, is not true. We know from mutation accumulation experiments that when you start introducing mutations into the population, your fitness goes down, right? So it's an interesting mode for some mutations, some substitutions. And it's actually, there's a paper by Michael Lynch from 87 that he finds something of that sort. Quick fluctuations, mean sigma goes to zero if you do the time average of that. So it's interesting, but then for the full genomic picture of evolution, that leads to very unfit state. And that, of course, is not what is the case in real systems. And there's another thing, of course. I have just chosen here two observables, and there are other observables here, and it will make these fast fluctuations will make difference, for instance, to allele frequency spectrums and stuff like that. And you can think about the adaptation then going on, like which I would call microadaptation. So you don't have any more adaptive substitutions, but you still will react. If you are a polymorphic state, you will still react for these changes in selection. And I have now drawn here one substitution, and the color is purple. And the reason for that is that I don't really know what color put there. It's, you know, it's gone through many, many changes. And I will now adapt the notion that I should take actually the time average of this process. I start from here, and I start just recording the time average of these flips, and then see what comes out. And that means that essentially for these microevolutionary fluctuations, where the mean fitness is zero, this selection coefficient for that substitution will get smaller and smaller. And I call this substitution quasi-neutral. I don't want to call it neutral for the reason that it will change the spectrum. This process will change the spectrum. So for the substitutions, it's quasi-neutral.
Well, the point is that any instant, if you could actually measure the fitness of the two alleles, they're different.
Yes, but
they're allegedly flip at the next instant.
Right, right. No. That's correct. But if you do that, then what I'm saying is that it's very important to notice that at that point, the allele has lost the correlation with the fitness state. So the fixed state, the substituted states, they don't anymore know what was the right thing or the better allele. So it becomes decoupled. So I think it's a useful to actually call that substitution a quasi-neutral one, and it's useful to separate this to microevolutionary regime, this kind of behavior. And I just want to now recap the implications of part one. And this is, for this plot, we need to make another step, which is that I wanted to introduce this concept with this one locus, two allele model, which is very, very easy to discuss. But you can also have a quantitative trait that is built with, let's say, 10, 15 different loci. And then you can have the same situation here. Time goes here up, and you have a static fitness landscape, and the lighter shade is again giving you the fitter state. And your population is mostly monomorphic. It's somewhere here. Then you have a substitution process going on. You go down a bit, you go up a bit, you go down again, and so forth. And this static landscape, kappa, just is the same as gamma here. And that's the driving. So there's no driving there. And you have, if you record all the substitutions that your process does, you have a symmetric spectrum. And at the static fitness landscape, there are then compensatory substitutions. And the fitness flux will be zero. And now I can again go to this macroevolutionary seascape, where you have these changes, but they are slow enough that you can actually, the genome has time to adapt. So you can do the same. You have surplus of substitutions going uphill. And that you can observe with genomic substitution coefficient distribution, which is skewed. It has a skew toward the positive fitness values. And that, of course, implies then that there are adaptive substitutions and the fitness flux is greater than zero. And now if you go to the microevolution seascape, again, this purple arrows, you don't really know where you're going. And then you have quasi-neutral substitutions, but the process will have some properties that are not neutral. Then, but the substitutions start to look like neutral ones. And like it was exactly in this microevolutionary context that this term seascape has first appeared. So there's a book by D.J. Merrill from, I think it's 91 or something like that. And the name of the book is The Adaptive Seascape. So he's talking about this very, very quick fluctuations. That's his mental picture for that. Okay.
So when you're doing that distribution there, mm-hmm. what counts as an event? You wait until something goes to fixation, mm-hmm. and you just measure the difference in fitness of that allele where it's fixed compared to the previous one.
Yes.
At what point? The previous one when the previous one was fixed, or the previous one?
Was fixed. So this is in the limit where mu times n is smaller, that you have the substitution events going one by one. Okay? And this is very useful limit for, let's say, binding sites.
So I don't really understand the right hand limit. What is sigma? That's what I'm saying.
This one.
No, the right hand one. Because the sigma has changed during the process, during the
Yes.
As you drew before.
It's the time average over that. Sorry. I thought that you were talking about this plot. Yeah. So that's the definition that I gave you previous slide, which is that I take the time average over the polymorphism. When you start from the fixed state, then you have this, you take a time average. So you basically, what you want to do, you want to see that is there a coherent movement with the sigma or not? And there's not, because it doesn't push you in the different states. So it's the adaptation disappears. Okay, so I have two case studies, and we have now used 40 minutes. So I think I will talk this first case study, and then we have a break. So evolution of yeast transcription factor binding sites. And this is yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae. I found a nice figure for that. And this is actually something that people are familiar with, because Justin Fake gave a talk about this like 1 week ago. And also I have discussed about this here last year. So I'm just going to going to give you an overview, because some of you were already at the Justin talk that Justin Fay gave. So the idea is that we have something that gives us a mapping from sequence to a molecular trait. And in the case of binding site, so we have here transcription factor, we have DNA sequence here, and then the transcription factor binds to the sequence. So you can define binding interaction with the sequence. And so you have a mapping from sequence to energy. And in some cases, this mapping is additive. So it depends only on the individual nucleotides. And you can sum over to get the total energy for the sequence. And people actually have tested that additivity thing basically by doing experiments in such a way that they have the binding sequence, and they actually then pull out this transcription factor from there, and then they introduce single mutants. From the single mutants, you get these individual energy contributions, and then they do the double mutants and see whether the two single mutants will predict you, give you the prediction for the double mutant, okay? And this they can do, and in some cases, it works very nicely. And I have to say here that now it's a very interesting time, because there's great work by Sebastian Merkel and Stephen Quake, when actually they measure these energy landscapes. So they actually measure many of these combinations. It's not anymore that they assume the additivity, but they can actually do many, many, many sequences using microfluidics. And they can then experimentally make this map. So that's one way to get it. There are some bioinformatics ways of getting it, just from statistical arguments. And then there's something that, if someone is interested, you should see the talk that Kurt Callan gave here last year. So you can actually go to experiments that you then, experimental data, binding assays, that you then use and infer these kind of energy models, okay? And then if you do this biophysics of these binding events, so essentially you have a DNA here, and you have the transcription factor, it can bind with two modes. So one is unspecific binding, so it just comes here and it diffuses around, and then you can go to the specific mode, and which is the real binding site. And there you can then derive binding probability, and you get a Fermi function for it. And this is something that gives us a good, because you can think that if the transcription factor comes, binds, gene regulation will start or stop. It is actually the only thing that's the functional element there. That's the only thing that you really need. So that is then probably a good variable to work when we start doing population genetic analysis. So that is like a molecular, quantitative molecular trait. And so that's exactly what I'm going to do here. So you can do population dynamics of binding sites. So you have now right, this process with drift mutation and selection, that kind of process that I just introduced in the very beginning. And you can study the process at the level of substitution dynamics with these fixed states. And then if you look at that, you have Kimura order rates, which define you the probability if you start at the lower fitter state, what is the probability that you make a substitution to a higher fitness state. And that just depends on the fitness difference in this way. So if you have a deleterious, if you have a mutation that lowers the fitness, its substitution probability is exponentially suppressed. But if you have a variant that increases the fitness, you have linear increase. And if you have then way if you have a stationary distribution, you have these site sequences of length, let's say 10 nucleotides. For them, you can derive a stationary equilibrium distribution. Okay, here, if your neutral mutation rates have detailed balance, it can be shown that then any fitness landscape, which is finite, will give you a distribution for the functional sequences. And this is work done by Johannes Berg, Stanna Willman, and Michael Lessig. So this is actually very interesting if you look at this relation here, because it means that, you know, we can quite easily construct a model for this background here, this neutron model. And it tells us that we have a link between the sites. We can link the neutron model and its fitness, selected model, neutron model, and the fitness together. And now we can go, actually, and we can go to real data, and we can try to find whether we can use this relation to learn something about genomic fitness landscapes. But you can see that this, at the moment, lives at the sequence space. And that's, of course, very bad, because sequence space, even for very short sequences, like of the length 10, is huge. So we kind of need to make some simplifications here. And the simplification, of course, is that we make the we use now the map. We have the map from sequence to a molecular phenotype. And we project all these ensembles to this binding energy. And we can just look genomic energy distributions. So I have my genomic sequence, my intergenic sequence. I take this binding energy map. I scan through it, and I record every position. I move it one. I record the binding energies that I have. I make a probability distribution out of it. And that's plotted here. The Cerevisia counts are these dots for this APF1 binding site. It's a global regulator. So it means that it's broad-acting. It has many binding sites across the genome. And these are these bumps here. And this blue line is something, it's a very naive neutral model, but it does very well. So I've just taken the single nucleotide frequencies across the genome, and then I generate random sequence with those frequencies. And then I scan through with the energy model, okay, that I have the mapping. And now we have the bump here. So we had this talk, we were looking for this bump. So that is the bump that I think people were discussing about. So that is the difference between the null expectation and then the real genomic counts. And what the equations in the previous slide show, that we can now equate this bump with the fitness landscape. Okay? But let's not move so fast, because this of course means that we need to assume something before we can do that. So these equations that link the evolution of or link the neutral model to the selected one, those distributions, they are either done over many populations or you follow the process for long evolutionary time. But of course, with real genomic data, we have neither one of these options. So what we have to do is that we take many of these instances of these binding sites across the genome, and we replace it's like replacing the time average with the genomic average. And this will work only if the individual fitness landscapes for these binding sites that are in front of different genes are similar. If they are widely different, then this averaging is not going to give us any useful information. But this is, of course, something that we need to assume it at this point, but we can test it later, which is great. And here, this shading with these bars, I'm just showing like a set of APF1 sites that we have identified doing cross-species comparisons between four yeast species. And they are nicely here at the low binding region. And then you can also look this experimental log intensity ratio here, this data from Li et al. And you have then genomic counts again with these dots. And then you have these sites. And they are nicely biased to this high binding region. And like I said, if you take the equation from the previous page and these genomic counts, you can then infer a fitness landscape. And if we think about what we want to really do here, it's that we have a mapping from sequence to phenotype. And then phenotype, we have now a way of linking it to fitness. And fitness plus the dynamics means that you should be able to predict things. Okay? And this is what we can try now. So we can go to cross-species comparisons, and I have here a comparison between four species. So we have Cervisia paradoxus, Cervisia micata, and Cervisia baianus. And here is the binding energy divergence, the difference between orthologous pairs. So we have an alignment. And we can compare the binding energies of these orthologous binding sites. And here, if you just ignore the colors, this is all the sites that we think are functional binding sites, APF1 binding sites. And then there's another complication here with yeast. And this is something that Justin Fay's lab and Eric Van Nieuwegen's lab have found out, that very frequently in yeast, binding sites overlap with other binding sites. So if we remove for that overlap, what is shown here with the darker shading, then this one fitness landscape will nicely explain, actually very well explain the data. And you know, I think this is very nice, because the Cervisia baianus sequence divergence is comparable to the human mouse distribution. So it's about 20 million years of evolution. And right, so it does a good job there. But let us now go back to the original question. So what makes what is the genomic footprint for adaptive evolution? So here we can see that on average this molecular phenotype is not changing here. So the mean stays close to zero. And indeed, if we take a closer look of that, we can see that if I plot this phenotype distribution of these sites for all these four species, so I just take all these sites that I have identified and I just make histogram them individually, and I put them on top of each other. So this distribution of functional sites is very much the same across all the species, and this is a non-trivial result. So it means that this distribution, these individual sites, do change their energy, but on average they don't. So this is something that is consistent with the static fitness landscape, the one that I've shown you there. And indeed, if you just do a trivial folding of the energy differences that I showed you in the previous slides, and compare the Cervisia paradoxus selection coefficients of fitness differences between the orthologous site pairs, it comes closely symmetric. So you can see that you have these moves that increase the fitness, but you have the moves that decrease the fitness. And you can go even further. There's now polymorphism data coming available from this Saccharomyces cerevisiae resequencing project. And you can augment this analysis with polymorphism data. And you can then form MacDonald-Kreitmann ratios. And for substitutions, if we define this as our reference point, so we say that all sigmas from -1 to 1, and that's 1, then sigmas that are lower than -1 have a lower MacDonald-Kreitmann ratio, and bigger than 1 have a bigger one. So this is, of course, telling us that there's lots of positive selection here. So we have positive selection. Evolution is a series of compensatory substitution, but there's no systematic change in this molecular phenotype. And that basically means that the fitness flux for this system is zero, and we have plenty of evidence for positively selected substitutions, but we don't have evidence for adaptation here. And okay, so at this point, I think it's good to have a...
This is sort of genome-wide net zero flux.
Yes.
So it would be interesting to eventually try to resolve for individual genes whose regulation might be changing adaptively.
Absolutely. So.
Some are increasing the number of these binding sites, and there's others that are by selection, and then maybe others that are.
Look, this is good. So let's just talk about this a bit more, because. Like, if I would only show you this picture here, so one way to obtain this would be that you would have a delta peak of fitness in a different fitness for every binding site in across all the things, and nothing would ever move. And we would see this kind of a picture, right? Okay, something moves a bit, but not much. But that, of course, we can refute with the previous slide where we had a lot of divergence there. So they actually move, the sites do change. But then things become interesting if you think that you have, maybe those moves only reflect the individual fitness changing across the thing. So that is, of course, a possibility, and we definitely cannot rule it out at this point. So they could be all adaptive moves. But all I'm saying that we can show that we can explain a lot of data by one equilibrium fitness landscape. We do find lots of positive selection, negative selection, but we don't find adaptation. It doesn't mean that we don't find it if we have a better way of testing it somehow. So this is just to highlight the fact that positive selection, finding positive selection does not equal yet proving adaptation. So many of these moves that I show in the previous slide here could be adaptive indeed, but yeah, at the moment we can't prove it.
So there's a bit of a problem with language, isn't there, when you say evidence for adaptation? Because what you mean is there's no more adaptation because it's already adapted.
Yes.
What you mean is it's adapted already.
Yes.
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 So I don't know what the best way of saying that is.
But you have to be extremely
careful when you say there's no adaptation.
Okay,
because so that gives people the impression that the binding sites are random or something.
You're right. You're right. Okay, so that's a very good point. So what I mean here is that it's consistent with equilibrium under a fitness landscape,
right.
Static fitness.
It's adapted but not evolved.
Yeah, it made it there.
A direction.
Yes, Loris.
I thought it was essential that you lumped many sites from the same genome, so that then you can talk about, you don't have to worry about the infinite site model and every mutation occurring only once, right? Because it's important for you to have this equilibrium.
Absolutely.
So going back to Marty's question, when he says, well, let's ask this question for a single gene, you can't really do it in this framework at all, right? Because then you have a coalescent and all the similarities.
Well, I can do something when I have polymorphism data, for sure, okay? So that's the first thing to do. So once I have polymorphism data, I can check that. But of course, I have at the moment absolutely no way of measuring the fitness landscape for individual gene because I have just one instance of that process. So that's no way. But it's not the model if you let every binding site to have a different fitness landscape, because with that you can explain all the stuff. I think this is a minimal model that we have here, and it explains a lot, right? So that is the logic, but for sure we can't do one.
So you're assuming the fitness landscape is the same for each of the binding sites.
Yeah, so
you're seeing different.
They don't have to be the same because you can do bounds, but it's like that you can do annealing approximation over the fitness landscape, and you get an average that still makes sense for the system. But if all the landscapes are widely different, the average is nonsense. But then it should not predict anything, right?
I mean, I suppose what's interesting is that a lot of evolution, you take the neutral model as kind of the minimal model, and you try to see where you can find departures. And at some level of generality, actually, a lot of, if you look at in this old work, the distribution of heterozygosity, they sort of fit the mutual distribution. At individual loci, perhaps they don't, but in any case, it's sort of a minimal model.
So
this like the binding sites is perhaps a better minimal model. It's a selection model.
Yeah, but that exactly. So
it's not a neutral model. It's a
right, but selection. That is the minimal model to explain
it's a
like
much better minimal model for those kinds of.
Right. So it's the you start from the equilibrium or the static fitness landscape, and you see how much you can explain with that.
And as you're saying, superficially, they.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so shall we have a break now? Okay, so before I tell you about this second case study, I just want to make one more comment on the previous yeast thing. So there was this paper by Alan Moses and from Michael Eisen's lab, and they did a yeast binding site evolution study using a different kind of a fitness model, but that model is also compatible with equilibrium. So that's another, and they studied many more factors in that. So please go and look that one up. Okay, so we have now two species, Melancaster and Simulans, and we have studied polymorphism in Melancaster and using the Drosophila Simulans as an outgroup. And this data comes from Klinka et al., Andofato and Ometto et al. And the aim is to now use this macroevolutionary fitness seascape model to do some inferences, genomic inferences in this data set. And let's see if there's evidence for adaptation. So can we show that there's positive fitness flux for fruit fly? And just to be clear with the data, so the comparisons go so that you have so-called in-group, and you sample randomly the in-group population, and then you take one out-group sample. This is the Simulans one. And I have here already denoted what are the differences between the out-group and in-group. And we call a locus polymorphic locus. If it has a different letter in the out-group than at some positions in the in-group. And we have a substitution event here where we have a different nucleotide in all the sampled in-group species. So this then gives us the frequency counts, and this will give a spectrum, like I showed you in the beginning, and we can then make inferences based on that data, that spectrum. So we have three competing models. So the first one is the macroevolution seascape. Then these species have some evidence for demographical population bottlenecks, especially the one that went to Europe. So we have to kind of control for that kind of a possibility of getting a weird shape in the polymorphism spectrum. And our demographical model is a square bottleneck and under equilibrium selection. So it's selection plus a bottleneck, okay? And then the third model is equilibrium selection model. And in these inferences, we always assume that the population at the ancestor state was at a stationary state, as given by the equations that I have here. And we sum over the ancestor state. And this is actually quite important, because some analysis that are in the literature actually assume that the ancestor allele is the same as the outgroup allele. And you make sometimes a mistake when you do that. And the mistake is not very, very large, but the problem is that the mistake will go exactly to the bins in the histogram or this outgroup directed polymorphism spectrums that is very sensitive, because it's actually those bins. The high-frequency polymorphism are the ones that give you a lot of evidence for positive selection, for instance. So that systematic small mistake can be quite bad. And okay, so we do Bayesian inference using together both the polymorphism and substitution data. And because our model doesn't have explicit linkages, we have independent loci. We have to somehow correct for that. So in Drosophila, the recombination rate is quite high, and you can actually do the standard Hill-Robertson analysis of the polymorphism correlation decay, and you can get a length scale there. So it's like 300 nucleotides, something like that. So the recombination rate is very high. And we then have to basically discount for the fact that our model assumes independent evolution. So we do then simulations, and we see how the score distribution decays. And it, in this case, the result was that we have the independent model gives you inflated score by a factor of 3. So we need to divide our score differences by 3 to get something that accounts for the fact that the samples are not actually independent. And here, what I plot are the data in dots and the different models. So k means that if k is 12, we have a substitution event between the species. If k is 0, we have the same nucleotide in all samples from the in-group and at the out-group. And I have normalized these distributions, because these are the conditional probabilities. Where do you observe the population after dime delta t that I showed you in the really beginning of this talk. So I have normalized them now that I don't have to do a log plot here. I have normalized them with the neutral model. So this is Q naught, which is a neutral model that best fits the fourfold symmetric sites. So it basically means that if the fourfold symmetric sites, which are these dots, squares, would evolve neutrally, and if I would have many samples from them, I would have a straight line. And indeed, you can see that this is the category that we have least counts, but it is very much compatible with straight line. So I can put a straight line here. So we do, when we do the full inference, we get sigma for the fourfold symmetric sites, which has error bars starting from 0 going all the way up to 3 or something. So we have to say that they are compatible with neutral evolution here. And then we have here non-synonymous changes. And what you can see immediately is that the polymorphism, you have much less polymorphism in the non-synonymous changes. And then you have some substitutions there. Okay? And then you can do this plot for intergenic, intronic, and UTRs. And the solid line is the model 1. Long dashed line is model 2, which is a demographical model. And then equilibrium selection model is model 3. And I'm not even plotting the neutral model. So the neutral model, you can see that if the neutral model is a straight line, it doesn't fit the data very well. So it's just very bad doing all that. And we do a joint inference of all this data. And we can then, this fits imply some numbers for selection, and then this driving gamma. And this is what I... Yeah?
Sorry, Peter Adolfani was here like a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I think, when I remember correctly, he told us that short introns taking away the splice sites are sort of the best proxy for neutral sites.
I haven't done any separation there. So you're saying that this class, you should still subdivide.
So apparently there's quite a substantial selection encoding bias on the four-fold synonymous ones. But sort of the short introns were what at least he was claiming had least selection.
Okay, so that's something that I need to check the spectrum for that. But like I said, this fourfold synonymous sites that I'm plotting here on the top, what we get for the error bounds are from 0 to 3 and stuff like that. And it means that it's not a big range. So it's actually what is the codon uses bias. So that's completely compatible with that. But then you can see that there's so much noise there that it's also completely compatible with no bias. Yeah. So it's just that we don't have enough data for that category. That's an interesting point. So this situation for this data, now that we have genome-wide polymorphism, at least in simulants, is much better now than it was 2 years ago. So 2 years ago, this is the data sets from Andofatta and Klinka and Ometo, and it's already a lot, but not for this category. But it is already like 200 kb or something like that. So it's a good data set already, and you can work with that, definitely. And then if we turn this into a fitness flux. So here I have marked the contours for fitness flux. And here is the driving, but now it's normalized in terms of the neutral mutation rate. So that's gamma divided by mu naught. And here's the inferred sigma. And you can see that for all genomic categories but the fourfold synonymous sites, the inference gives a substantial sigma. These numbers actually, at the time when we published this paper, were much higher than other estimates. And there were actually some estimates at that point of time that were near neutral for these categories. And some for non-synonymous sites, people had not near neutral changes, but still order of magnitude lower. And they all have this finite kappa. So it means that you have really positive fitness flux going through these categories.
Just to understand the scale here, the neutral mutation rate is 10 to the minus 8 per base per generation?
Yes.
So it's 10 to the minus 7 years?
10 to the minus 7 years. Right, 10 generations per year, right? So you can convert these numbers, and you can think that it's about one change in selection per genome per year. So it's a big number. So that's nice. And so it's these two things together, which is that we have considerable sigma and gamma, that then give us the evidence that these Drosophila genomes are evolving with adaptive substitutions, and this far from equilibrium. And you can see that it's not enough to have gamma if you don't have sigma, because you don't follow then the selection. So you need both. You need to have substantial selection and then also this changes in selection. And this paper by Petrov lab, MacPherson et al., who have been looking for pervasive sweeps in Drosophila, they get fitness flux values that are comparable what we have here. And that is then very interesting, because they are sampling a different scale for the selection. They are sampling things that are much higher, which we can see from the spectrum. Because if you have very, very high selection coefficient, the polymorphism time is so short that it doesn't leave. It just shows us the substitution. So for instance, here, we can't really, for the non-synonymous sites, if we only sample 12 species, we get, this is the maximum likelihood value, but we can't put the upper bound, we can't close it. We need more samples from the species. So then you start seeing the shape of the spectrum better.
So how do you distinguish fluctuating sign of the selection versus the driving force from simply not being at the peak in the first place and going uphill?
Right. This is one of the things that obviously is very hard to tell. So we assume the stationarity at the ancestor state. So we think that the process has to be described self-consistently. So you basically need to explain the ancestor state. You are saying that maybe that's far away from equilibrium. I'm at the stationary state. I'm at the stationary state. So what I'm saying is that, of course, you could just have a situation that you somehow start far from equilibrium and then have equilibrium dynamics and interpret that as a flux. That's for sure. But I'm saying here that we assume the stationarity because then it's nice. Because it means that we actually know how we arrive to that state. These parameters fix you. The driving and the sigmas will fix you the stationary state. The ancestor state then doesn't have any special. It's not a state that you take as given. But this is something that we can now, when we have multiple species with polymorphism data, we can actually then start checking if the stationarity assumption makes sense or not. But at the moment, it is an assumption here in this analysis. So that we think that the process has reached a stationary state, and hence we sample the ancestor allele with the stationary state probabilities, and then we can sum over it, and we get the probability distributions for these spectrums.
But it's not that each nucleotide sort of went back and forth here several times.
We don't need that, because we have in one category, we have lots of instances from that process. So we get that average right. So we don't, one nucleotide, obviously.
But so the basic ingredient is that this changing fitness gives you the beneficiary mutation target that is always kind of comparable.
Maybe I don't get that point. So.
So you can also say that you have some, basically, you're running after some peak, which is sort of moving.
That's a flux condition as well, so that you have a moving fitness target, right?
But that is this, isn't it?
Right. So it's just this gamma is just giving you the speed of that, and how you are at what point then you would be at the ancestor state, right? So this is time dependent.
The beginning is that each locus was going back and forth.
Well, that's the way to introduce the model. But obviously, if you then sample many independent loci, then you get the right ancestor probability. So that's the thing.
Well, I guess I don't quite understand that. So you're basically saying because this infinite site model is sort of intrinsically out of equilibrium.
Exactly, and that is the problem there.
Well, wait.
yeah.
But if I understand correctly, you're somehow saying that nevertheless, starting with an infinite site model and then averaging over lots of regions, you can recover an equilibrium model, right, where things flip back and forth. And that, I don't quite understand that.
I'm not sure that I get your point there. So. The problem with this infinite site model is that you put the system to begin with to be out of equilibrium. You don't have a back mutation. There's no way that you can define even an equilibrium.
I don't know if it's a problem or a solution or just a reality. Mm-hmm.
Right. So look, you can think about the infinite sites model in a way that you have an ancestor state and you take it as given. And then from that state, you start observing the substitutions going on.
Right.
And for individual ones, you then label, let's say, +2, -2, whatever. So what I'm saying here, that if you take the stationary state as your starting point, or even let's take the equilibrium, that's the easier one to talk. I'm saying that at equilibrium, if we assume that the ancestor state was at equilibrium, we can do the same inference. And the plus and minus substitutions are then connected, and the balance of the number of plus and minus substitutions changes as a function of the driving. So it will, in some sense, if you have infinite amount of data, you will get in the end the same sigmas, but it's the balance of sigmas going up and going with sigma plus and sigma minus that will tell you something about the dynamics. And you can have equilibrium, you can have going plus sigma and minus sigma, and you can still be at the equilibrium, or you can be driven. But that analysis, if you start from infinite sites, it's not going to give you an answer to that. So you will get sigmas out from there. And actually, we in this paper, we looked at that. And if you do that kind of stuff, you can infer things. You can infer the things if you are in a certain parameter range. But essentially, in this not so strongly selected stuff, you need this equilibrium option as well. So let's see just like what would be then what drives the waves of this fitness seascape. So one thing is of course epistasis. Substitutions in so let's see that we had a fresh substitution event here. It can change the selection coefficient at different positions in the genome. And you can see that this dynamics would go on, and those would trigger the new substitutions. The other option is, of course, that we have just external chains. We could have environmental changes or competition between species. It's probably both of them and also many other things that I have no idea. At the moment, definitely, we have no way of telling what are the contributions from there. I can only say that the fact that the selection chain's timescale is comparable to substitution timescale or the neutral rate would somehow tell you that epistasis is the thing that we are seeing here. So that it goes and then it changes. And
wouldn't epistasis just be a more complicated equilibrium model? I mean, it wouldn't be. So I'm imagining a protein structure, and it's easy to see that if I change the amino acid at one place, that might influence the selection on another.
Right.
So that's like your epistasis.
Yes. You are kind of saying that, like, epistatic model, the equilibrium timescale would be so large that with that context, it makes no sense of talking about equilibrium. But like that.
I'm just saying that really that if it was like that, it would still be some equilibrium. Right? It wouldn't be the same thing that you're talking about.
Oh, well, it would, because that like at the single locus level, like we do this observation now, we can define the problem there at single locus level. And then we can actually measure the correlation of the fitness effect at that locus. Mm-hmm. And we see that that changes as a function of time. And epistasis is one reason for that. But then you would define it as a full sequence level, I think, what you are talking about. But that's a good point. So this I have to think. So I want to conclude now. So like the yeast example, I hope made it clear that we can gain something by making a bit sharper definition of adaptive evolution. And it's not enough to find positive selection in a genome to say that there's adaptation going on at that point of time. So instead, these adaptive substitutions take place at a macroevolutionary seascape, which will give a rise to a positive fitness flux. And this is then interesting in the sense that these changes in the direction of selection, or changes in the selection, will always happen before the adaptive substitution. So that will fix a causality in macroevolutionary timescales. And I have now here this first plot that I started with, and I have put here that there's no fitness flux here. I have removed the time label, and if I now just flip over the time, it looks exactly the same. At the macroevolutionary timescale, this process, the static fitness landscape and evolution under it, is time reversible. And you don't see anything weird going on there. But now if we put on this driving this evolution under macroevolutionary fitness seascape, we have first, in the normal case, we have positive fitness flux. Then we have these adaptive substitutions. But then if we do the same thing and change the direction of time, you can see that it becomes really weird. You somehow make these preemptive substitutions, and they are, of course, nonsensical. So the time dependence in selection will then fix the time in the direction of time in molecular evolution. And just before closing, like it's very, very easy to make very complicated models. And it's very nice to work with real data, because they are like the reality check, what we are doing. That can you explain the data that you have and very much appreciate all the work that people have put for these data sets that we have been using and analyzing. Okay, thanks.
So I'm still hung up on this equilibrium, not equilibrium. So I guess I can understand that if you take some chunk of sequence, say the gene, then over some very long period of time, there'll be as many positive mutations as negative mutations. However, each and every one will be different, right? Basically assume that nothing ever happened twice, but on average, the fitness has not budged very much,
mm-hmm.
right? But then I would say that since negative mutations...
Nothing mutual happened twice, presumably. Things are beneficial some of the time, but lots of time.
Well,
populations are
okay. Wait, so, okay. I guess what I'm trying to say is, it's probably reasonable to say that positive mutations are more rare than the negative ones.
That you get out from this stationary state. So you know that you are in adapted state, and you then know precisely what fraction of things are at the current time beta state. So you are right. If the genome is adapted, then you have more negative mutations coming in, right?
But wait, but doesn't this basically say that you're... So comparing that situation where, you know, detailed balance is recovered on the level of... fitness,
right?
Rather than on the level of a single polymorphism, which flips back and forth.
Look,
that there, you know, if I'm actually looking at the polymorphism, then there is the conversion factor.
You're right.
I will see many more.
Look, like the detailed balance is at the level of substitutions, right? So it's at the level of substitutions the detailed balance condition holds, okay? And this equilibrium notion, it's better to understand that at the molecular phenotype level, so that you have a quantitative trait, and it can be many different loci that will then restore it. But at individual nucleotide level, then that is slightly different.
Right, but so there has to be this sort of density of state kind of conversion factor which I guess we don't know, and I don't quite understand how that comes into your calculation where you actually try to interpret the data looking at polymorphisms. Imagine with that factor, I can make the positive selection look like negative selection and vice versa.
I'm not sure. I don't think so. We can still, like, even with these binding sites, if we think about them at the full molecular phenotype level, we can still observe the individual columns as well. And I don't really see where there would be a problem. So you get a spectrum for this process. You get a sequence. You get a polymorphism spectrum. And then you can try to interpret that.
See, I guess this is why I started asking questions in the second part of the talk and the first, because in the first part of the talk, I thought that the fact that you had is basically identical binding sites, well, not quite identical, but functionally identical mm-hmm. binding site, repeated many times in the genome,
right.
was actually allowing you to talk about real equilibrium, real recurrence. That
yes.
even though in any particular binding site, you may not have had a reversal of any particular mutation, they have occurred in an ensemble of your 200
look,
binding sites.
No, I agree. But look, at the phenotype level, this is... you don't have to have the compensation coming from the same point mutation reversed. But you can have it at a different locus.
But then I think you have some conversion factor. You have some density of state type thing, no?
It depends on your trait. So with the binding sites, you have something like that, right?
All right. So with binding sites, your model of just
no, that's not,
execution
look,
is probably pretty
look,
good.
Look.
But when you start talking about
we don't know what is the right unit there. So this what I discussed here, this theoretical stuff works for small units because we still have like individual substitution events going on. We don't have a competition between them like within one functional unit. But yeah, so for short genomic units, I think what I've shown today is that with equilibrium notion, you actually gain something. You can explain a lot of data, and it's a sensible assumption. Or you can check that.
So I'm wondering whether your model can have a kind of a Muller's ratchet regime to it, where you are going downhill, whether you're out of equilibrium and going downhill as opposed to being out of equilibrium and adapted.
Well, I'm glad that you asked. So I think the Muller's ratchet thing doesn't work if you have back mutation. So there's just you have this. I don't see this Muller's ratchet, the whole setup, because what you have there is that you have some initial state, and then you start putting one-way mutation in that, and the ratchet will click. So that's fine. You know what you get. You get downhill moves. But why do you have that kind of dynamics if your initial state is then not a state from that dynamics?
So your model has two mm-hmm. alleles, and the mutation rate is equal both ways.
Yes.
So therefore, if there's no gamma, you're in an equilibrium with
right.
no adaptation. And if there is a gamma, then you're
surplus of,
right.
yes.
So suppose you have four alleles, like for DNA bases,
mm-hmm.
with equal mutations, then you've got three times as much downhill mutation as uphill mutation, right?
Right.
And so there might be a regime where the mutation is winning,
You're right. You're right. And this you can actually you can solve this four allele problem and you're right. So then you can actually if you just increase the mutation rate enough, then the state probabilities of being in one of the less fit alleles will win. Yeah. The sigma that
and
you have.
Doesn't that
there.
Mean your flux is a downhill flux?
No. You can still have equilibrium there at the same Yeah. So you can have a steady state or equilibrium state with state probabilities that are not favoring the selected allele because of this entropy effect, that you have many things. But it doesn't mean that the detailed balance condition would not hold.
But if you would have driving from this system, then would it mean that you're constantly going down? If you each time you make a flip, you avoid the better state?
We can...
Or is it...
It's quite funny because we kind of discussed through this in Blackboard. With Luca, so no, there's no problem with that. If you have equilibrium system, and you still kill the flux, it reaches a detailed balance, and then well, it gets more complicated for sure. So then you kind of need to decide what is your non-equilibrium model. If you flip between so we looked at that kind of stuff in the supporting text just to see that we are not fooling ourselves, and what we did there is that the fittest state will then change randomly. So the permutation of this selection coefficient. So I guess that is already quite interesting because with four alleles, you have many different ways of doing the fluctuations, right? So if you have this random permutation, there's no problem. So things will work like here. But yeah, so this is something that you should think about.
All right.